แหละ
Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You listen to the sound of universal compassion. Today's 19th of February. We will continue listen to Tenton's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. And please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome back to the program today. After 6 weeks in the heat and mugginess of Darwin, I'm back in a much cooler Hamilton and ready to continue with our discussion of Shanti Deva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. In the last program we did on this text in late March, we came to the end of the chapter on confession. So today we're going to start the third chapter, which Stephen Batchelor's translation of the text calls Full Acceptance of the Awakening Mind, and which Pema Chodron in her commentary No Time to Lose calls Transcending Hesitation. As I've mentioned before, the text we're following is like a manual to develop bodhicitta, the mind that wishes to attain enlightenment, because that's the best way to lead all our other beings out of the various miseries of psychic existence. We've covered the first two chapters, the opening one covering the benefits of developing bodhicitta, and the second purifying negativities, or as I said before, confession. In her commentary on the confession chapter, which she incidentally calls Preparing the Ground, Pema Chodron points out that Shanti Deva covers the popular Tibetan Buddhist seven-limb practice to purify negativities from the mind and gather merit or positive potential. The seven limbs are prostrating, making offerings, confessing negativities, rejoicing, requesting the teachers to remain, and then requesting them to teach, and finally, dedicating one's positive potential. The first three are covered in the confession chapter, and the last four in the chapter we're about to embark on. So we've gone through prostrating, making offerings, and confessing negativities, and now we'll be looking at rejoicing, requesting to remain and to teach, and dedication. But now, before we go any further, let's set our motivation, as we've done in previous programs, examining why we are participating in the program today, and if we find some minor motivation, perhaps to do with present comfort or status, to change it to something more beneficial, like bodhicitta. Even if we do not feel we are capable of relieving our own dissatisfaction, never mind that of vast numbers of other beings. Just trying to generate the bodhicitta mind is helpful, because it is focused on not causing harm to others, whoever they are, but helping as much as possible instead. So, as the focus is so broad, the positive potential bodhicitta generates is very great. And we need lots of positive potential, even just to make this and coming lives happy, never mind becoming enlightened. So now, let's take a moment to try to generate such a motivation. Thank you. Now, Shanti Deva starts off the chapter with verses on rejoicing. He says, "Gladly do I rejoice in the virtue that relieves the misery of all those in unfortunate states and that places those with suffering in happiness. I rejoice in that gathering of virtue that is the cause for the Arhat's awakening. I rejoice in the definite freedom of embodied creatures from the miseries of cyclic existence. I rejoice in the awakening of the Buddhas and also in the spiritual levels of their sons. And with gladness, I rejoice in the ocean of virtue from developing an awakening mind that wishes all beings to be happy, as well as in the deeds that bring them benefit." As Pema Chodron points out, being happy in others' good fortune actually is very good for our own minds, especially when we are having difficulty connecting. We might feel trapped in our own misery. No one understands or could understand, and we feel a sense of disconnect from others. People with problems have sometimes said to me that they envy others who always seem happy or content. They think that they're the only ones with difficulties. I say to them, go and talk to the people you think are so happy, and you'll soon see that they are just like you with their own challenges. Sometimes others' problems are much greater than ours, and realizing that we are not the most unfortunate creature on earth, we can begin to feel compassionate and reconnected. But then also, when we see or hear about others' good fortune, no matter who they are, we can build on that by feeling really happy for them. Not only does this lift our own mind and strengthen our sense of connection, it also opens us up emotionally. Pema Chodron recommends that whenever we go out, walking in the street, shopping, going to work and so on, we practice focusing our attention on the people we see and wishing them to be well and happy. She says, even if we don't know very much about them, and I quote, they can become very real by regarding each of them personally and rejoicing in the comforts and pleasures that come their way. Each of us has this soft spot, a capacity for love and tenderness. But if we don't encourage it, we can be pretty stubborn about remaining sour. But she warns that rejoicing in others' good fortune, you also come face to face with your own competitiveness and envy. That is also a plus, though. She says, who would have thought that the practice of rejoicing would be a setup for seeing our own neurosis? Our usual response would be to feel that we have blown it. But for aspiring bodhisattvas, this isn't the case. Because our intention is to wake up so we can help others do the same, we rejoice as much in seeing where we're stuck as we rejoice in our loving kindness. It's the only way to practice real compassion, she says. By seeing where we go wrong, we get a better understanding when others mess up, especially when they're trying to free themselves of misery, but keep on reverting to the behaviors that foster dissatisfaction. Like us, she says, they have the capacity for joy, and out of ignorance they block it. For their sake and ours, we can let the storylines go and stay present with an open heart, and we can rejoice that we're even interested in such a fresh alternative. These words put me in mind of another great Buddhist practitioner, Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese founder of Engaged Buddhism. If you haven't read any of his books yet, I recommend that you do so. His wisdom and compassion just flow out of them. He echoes Pema Chodron when he says that if we face our unpleasant feelings with care, affection, and non-violence, we can transform them into a healthy energy that has the capacity to nourish us. Thich Nhat Hanh is the master of mindfulness and claims that by the work of mindful observation, our unpleasant feelings can illuminate so much for us, offering us insight and understanding into ourselves and society. Now, returning to Shantideva's text, in the first verse, he says, gladly do I rejoice in the virtue that relieves the misery of all those in unfortunate states and that places those with suffering in happiness. This, His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, is an expression of rejoicing in positive rebirths and their causes. The unfortunate states that Shantideva mentions are the three lower realms, the animal, preta, and hell realms, where the beings have the most suffering. In line with his wish to bring all beings happiness and relieve them of suffering, Shantideva rejoices in the positive potential that they have created and that will free them from those states of suffering and promote their rebirth in one of the higher realms as a human, Asura, or God. Now, us Westerners might be a bit skeptical about talk of hell and other realms, but we have to remember that from a Buddhist point of view, our state of mind determines whether we are living and will continue living in misery or not. Someone who cannot find a single good thing in his or her life is already in a hellish state. The next door to a place I was staying in some time ago was owned and run by a family for their mother. One of the owners came round from time to time to maintain the section, and one day I saw him hacking at a flax that was on our side of the boundary of his and our property. I went out to talk to him, just to be neighborly and find out why he was swiping at the fax. He told me first that fax is a nuisance, but that led on to a litany of miseries in his life. He had cancer and only had 6 months to live. He and his wife didn't get on. He was arguing with his sister, who lived overseas, and one disaster followed on from another. His whole body showed how disgruntled he was, though after we had talked a while, he seemed a bit calmer. He may not have been suffering great physical torments, but mentally he was in a very unpleasant state, and he's an indication of how we can persuade ourselves into a hell realm by the way we think. It is, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, when he writes, "When our mind is not yet calm, when it's still agitated, we can't really be happy. Our happiness or lack of happiness depends mostly on the state of our mind, not on anything external. It's our own attitude, the way with that we look at things, our approach to life, that determines whether we are happy or not. We've plenty of conditions to be happy already, so why should we have to go searching for more?" More than 6 months after I spoke to our neighboring landlord, I saw him again briefly. He was still alive and not much different in appearance from how I'd found him before. I didn't speak to him, but I wonder if he rejoiced at the time he had to live and made the most of turning it into a happy time. Probably not. You might think me quite callous, but I often refer to another story that really inspires me about one very great Tibetan Lama who got cancer. Now, if you've listened to these programs before, you will have heard me talk about his story, but it's so inspiring, I don't think it does any harm to be reminded of it again and again. Anyway, this Lama learned that he had liver cancer and could only expect to live a few weeks. He was a practitioner of Tonglen, the practice of taking all the sufferings of others onto oneself and giving them all your happiness. He had many devoted disciples all over the world, and his attendant was worried about letting them all know that he would soon be dead. But the Lama said to the attendant, "I'm fully aware of the fact that the disease, especially at this stage, is incurable. But I'm not sad or disappointed in any way. When Professor Olivier Arie informed me of the presence of a tumor in my liver, I thought immediately that he was so very, very kind. He was extremely kind to me." We all practice Tonglen with a specific aim to prolong the life of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Of course, I've recited certain verses from Lama Chöpa many times. "And thus, compassionate gurus, we seek your blessings that all karmic debts, obstacles, and sufferings of mother beings may without exception ripen upon us right now, and that we may give our happiness and virtue to others and thereby invest all beings in bliss. As well as, in order to rescue all beings from the vast seas of existence, we seek your blessings to become adept in bodhicitta through a pure selfless wish, and by love and compassion, conjoined with the visual technique of mounting, giving and taking upon the breath." But it was all more or less mere theory for me. When I was told that I have cancer, I did not feel sad or upset. On the contrary, my mind was uplifted, and it felt light and open. I thought, finally, I have the chance to put this theory into practice now. My prayers have come true. How wonderful. I intend to use whatever time I have left in order to deepen my practice of Tonglen. What would be the benefit of trying to conceal my situation? I think it is far better that people know that I have come to manifest this tumor and now I can really practice. I don't want you to be sad. I want you to be happy and inspired, since I now have such a wonderful opportunity to practice in a way that all bodhisattvas do. My doctor has been so kind to me. Why would I ever want to hide the fact that I'm now practicing in the footsteps of the bodhisattvas?" 2 months later, he was very weak and hardly eating. His attendant asked him, "Rinpoche, is that bad cancer causing you pain?" He replied, "Alak, there is no such thing as bad cancer. When you practice Tonglen, all sickness is good. If you say that you will take upon yourself the suffering of all sentient beings, you should expect some physical discomfort. It's not possible to practice Tonglen without physical discomfort. In order to practice, you must have something that causes you pain and discomfort. This illness is good, This illness allows me to practice. Without it, I could not practice. Alak, I am constantly meditating, either seeing myself as the deity or equalizing and exchange self and others. It always helps. Most of the time, I am free of pain. How extraordinary that one can rejoice even in the very face of death. Compare his attitude and the happiness he felt even as he died to that of the landlord who could find nothing good in the world, and you can see how even on earth heaven and hell are created. If we can find nothing positive to rejoice about, we condition our minds into believing that life is hell, and so hell is where we put ourselves. On the other hand, if we can find peace and joy in every moment, even in our direst moment, we will be getting close to living in Nirvana now and also training our mind to live in that state in the future. Now, Shantideva goes on in the second verse, I rejoice in that gathering of virtue that is the cause for the Arhat's awakening. I rejoice in the definite freedom of embodied creatures from the miseries of cyclic existence. In this second verse, he rejoices in the gathering of virtue. That is the cause for the enlightenment on Arhat. This gathering of virtue refers to the trainings in morality, concentration, and wisdom that are the gateway leading out of samsara. When we start the Buddhist path, we have to lay down a foundation for practice, and that is known as the Vinaya, or training in morality. On that basis, we can build a powerful concentration, leading to calm abiding, and with calm abiding, we analyze reality until we see it as it really is. In other words, until we say goodbye to cyclic existence forever. Pema Chodron's spin on this is that Shantideva rejoices in the possibility of gaining such an enlightenment, and also in having role models like the Arhats to follow. Freedom is possible, she says, and we have the role models to prove it. If they can do it, so can we. Then in the two-line verse 3, Shantideva says, I rejoice in the awakening of the Buddhas and also in the spiritual levels of their sons. The awakening of the Buddhas is, of course, full enlightenment, and the Buddha's sons are the bodhisattvas who progress through 10 levels or grounds to full Buddhahood. The main difference between the Arhats and the bodhisattvas is motivation. The Arhats practice for their own enlightenment only, while the bodhisattvas aim to attain enlightenment to lead all other beings to enlightenment as well. Now verse 4 goes like this. And with gladness I rejoice in the ocean of virtue from developing an awakening mind that wishes all beings to be happy, as well as in the deeds that bring them benefit. As we said when we went through the first chapter to this text, developing the mind of bodhicitta, the mind that wishes to attain enlightenment to benefit all sentient beings, leads to a very great increase in our positive potential of virtue. And here, Shantideva rejoices in that very fact. Because the object of bodhicitta is all beings everywhere, this awakening mind is very vast, and so the positive potential is great. I must admit that when I think of benefiting all sentient beings, that is all the humans, all the insects, all the fish, animals, birds, reptiles and mammals, as well as all the other types of beings that I know nothing about throughout space and time, my mind does feel uneasy. I can hardly help myself, so how can I think of helping others completely free themselves from dissatisfaction and misery? This is really too great a task. Pema Chodron answers that actually it's just a way of examining our experience and seeing if we have feelings of aggression, dislike, envy, fear, and so on towards anybody else. When we stop and take time to look into our normal behavior, it becomes obvious that our natural instinct is to slot people into one of three categories: friend, enemy, or stranger. By enemy, I don't necessarily mean someone we want to kill or maim, but someone who makes our mind uncomfortable when we think about them. For a Labour supporter, such a person might be John Key, for instance. A member of the Labour Party might not want to harm Mr. Key in any way, apart from getting him out of office, perhaps, but there's no warmth in their heart for him either. In English, we don't really have a word for such a person, so enemy has been made to fit. But it's a description that nevertheless includes anyone from such a slightly disliked person to someone who is loathed with a passion. By seeing people as friends, enemies, and strangers, we discriminate. And by discriminating, we open ourselves up to emotional reactions. We cling to our friends, even to the point of killing for them. We try to harm our enemies in whatever way we can, and we ignore strangers, even though they may be in dire straits. Can you see how much emotional turmoil this brings? And yet, friends, enemies, and strangers are as fragile as a morning breeze. In the AM, it might be quite strong. By midday, it has mostly died away, and by the evening, it has been supplanted by another type of wind entirely. How many of the friends that you had, say, 10 or 15 years ago are still your friends? How many enemies have stayed enemies for 10 or 15 years? I think if you're truthful, you will have to say you may not even recognize most of them if you pass them in the street. Furthermore, a friend can become an enemy in the space of a few words. And similarly, your feelings towards an enemy can change very quickly if that enemy did something that was very helpful to you. So it's not as if slotting people into these three categories is either effective or important. It's just a rather bad method to cope with the others in our lives, a method we never think much about, and so it causes us a lot of harm. But getting rid of it is difficult. We've been practicing it for so long, over many lives, that it is now almost second nature to us. Still, if we decide to develop the awakening mind, bodhicitta, as Shantideva suggests, we have no choice. We must see all others with equal warm heart. So we start with generating the aspiration, and then train ourselves a step at a time. Of course, warm-hearted equanimity will not happen quickly. The Buddha took eons in his training. So we have to be realistic and not feel we have failed if we still find ourselves with some antagonism towards someone else. As Pema Chodron advises, these old habits die hard. Allow ample time for change to occur so you don't lose heart just because the process goes slowly. In any case, by practicing rejoicing, we can more easily overcome our feelings of jealousy and competitiveness for others, for rejoicing in their good fortune is the antidote to those harmful feelings. Going back to the verse, the line that wishes all beings to be happy refers to aspirational bodhicitta, and the deeds that bring them benefit reflect engaged bodhicitta, the mind that is actually diligent in the work of the bodhisattva, the six perfections. As Pema Chodron says, once the intention to awaken for the benefit of others becomes our guiding principle, even emotional upheavals won't lead us astray. People who are clear about their commitment become like mountains, remaining steady even when the weather gets wild. And she makes the point that we should take this to heart, otherwise we might think that we can't actually do anything to better benefit others until we are free of our own emotional turmoil. If our commitment is strong, then even when we are going through rough patches in our lives, we can still be of great benefit to others. Like the Tibetan Lama who died of liver cancer. His attendant reported soon after he was admitted to hospital that everyone from neighboring wards wanted to visit and spend time with the Lama because he was so peaceful and joyous and so engaged with others. So you can see, we can even be dying a rather horrible death and still bring goodwill and happiness into others' lives. That Lama obviously had the bodhisattva attitude. The chapter now goes into the fifth limb of the seven-limb practice, requesting the Buddhas to teach. Shantideva covers this with a single verse. With folded hands I beseech the Buddhas of all directions to shine the lamp of Dharma for all bewildered in misery's gloom. His Holiness says that by the Buddhas of the ten directions, the author is particularly referring to the Buddhas who have not yet started teaching. It is true that some Buddhas do not teach, finding that even though they have been born to help beings, these beings are not yet ready for the teachings. So a Buddha in that situation will help in other ways. And some, like Shakyamuni Buddha, might need a request when on becoming enlightened under the Bodhi tree, They question whether they should teach, whether anyone will understand what they're saying. And so, to ensure that those who are enlightened and can teach will do so, we request them to shine the lamp of Dharma. This particular phrase refers to both the oral and written instructions and the realizations that come from studying, contemplating, and meditating on those instructions. And what do those realizations accomplish? Bringing light to those bewildered in misery's gloom. In other words, he is talking about beings that are afflicted with emotions and the obscurations that prevent them from seeing reality as it is, and that leave subtle stains on their minds, preventing omniscience. According to Pema Chodron, by asking the wise to clarify our confusion, we counteract wrong views, like believing that all beings are basically bad, or that karma is a kind of punishment dealt out by outer forces. The second last of the seven limbs is requesting the Buddhas not to pass away. Shantideva puts in the sixth verse of the chapter like this: "With folded hands I beseech the conquerors who wish to pass away to please remain for countless eons and not to leave the world in darkness." Basically, this is asking the Buddhas not to pass away into a state of parinirvana, the final state after death of a great being. The Maha Parinirvana Sutra says that a number of times before he passed into parinirvana, the Buddha hinted to his attendant Ananda that a Buddha could extend his life for 100 years, or the remainder of 100 years. But Ananda failed to understand the hint, and so did not request the Buddha to live on. Only after the Buddha had decided the time of his death did Ananda finally understand, but his request then came too late. On the basis of this, we then make requests to the Buddhas not to pass away, but to use their powers to continue living and teaching for, as Shantideva says, countless eons. And when Shantideva makes the request, his purpose is so that the world is not left in darkness, meaning the darkness of ignorance, particularly the ignorance that does not understand the nature of reality. Pema Chodron points out that wisdom and compassion are always within our grasp, but if we don't know how to reach them, it is unlikely we will even consider them. We need examples of what can be done and realize our inner strength and power. Great teachers like the Buddha show us these unlimited qualities of our mind, and so we need such teachers as living examples to constantly remind us. Therefore, we request them to remain so that we can overcome our fears, particularly of continuing in confusion and ignorance. And now we come to the last of the seven limbs. Shantideva says, "Thus, by the virtue collected through all that I have done, may the pain of every living creature be completely cleared away. This is a dedication for the happiness of all living beings and complete Buddhahood in accordance with the Bodhisattva attitude." When he says "all I have done," Shantideva is referring to the other six limbs that he's already gone through. In general, Pema Chodron says the practice of dedication helps to overcome self-absorption and miserliness. We imagine everything we have, our possessions, our body, and even our merit, and give it away to other sentient beings to eliminate their suffering. We have to let go of possessiveness altogether with the thought that may whatever happens be for the best, whether it is pleasure or pain. Then, as the master Chogyam Trungpa says, there will be nothing for the ego to hold on to. It's a very big ask. Do you think you can do it? I leave you with that question, for the time is up. Please dedicate any positive potential we've accumulated with this program to your purpose, especially gaining enlightenment, so we can best benefit all others. Thanks for joining me today, and I hope you'll do so again next week.